The term globalism brings to mind big money, Wall Street, international trading, big competition. But maybe China's Belt and Road is a new aspect of globalism, connecting people by road, sea and train links. A sort of 21st century Orient Express on steroids. Koliko godina je prošlo, a još mi nije pošlo, vuk samotnjak sam posto, dan I dana sam stolelo. We hear a lot of talk about globalisation, and when we talk about it, people tend to think of money zipping around the world because business is becoming global and big corporations. But there's another way to look at it, and it's important that we understand this. There's a recent article in Project Syndicate called New Old Globalisation, written by Harold James. We've spoken to him before. He's Professor of History and International Affairs at Princeton University. And he joins us now from New Jersey. Harold James, welcome back to Counterpoint.
Good to speak with you, Amanda.
Now, what's going on with the European Union and how they look at China and the Belt and Road initiative? As I understand it, Belt and Road is sort of two things. One, a plan to challenge the West internationally, and two, to try and, you know, spread China's influence away from the coast. I mean, like most countries, they've got a coastline. That's where most of the Chinese are, and they need to do both of those. There's been a lot of publicity recently about Italy, for example, signing up an MOU. How do you see the European response to Belt and Road?
Well, obviously, Europe is at one end of the belt part of the Belt and Road Initiative. And so it's an attempt, it's a really bold attempt to connect the eastern and the western ends of the Eurasian landmass and to develop not just the trade through the water routes, but an overland line. And the railroad line that terminates at the moment in Duisburg in Germany is really incredibly active at the moment. It's been a great success. It's taken off. And so you might think, well, the Europeans would welcome that. And I think there are some voices that think it's very, very positive. But there's also a kind of disturbing element to it, which is that, to some people at least, China appears to be playing off some members of the European Union against other members of the European Union. And the whole thing is a bit shaky at the moment. It's the aftermath of the euro crisis. It's the crisis in the wake of the UK decision to go for Brexit and then not really knowing what Brexit is going to bring. And so there's a lot up in the air, the geopolitics, the question of what the relationship between the European Union and the United States is also up in the air with the Trump presidency. And so this looks like a moment for some Europeans of vulnerability, and they're worried, I think, that China is going to use it to take European technologies, but then not to do very much for the whole economic development of Europe.
And some of the choices haven't appeared sort of as smart as, have they? I mean, if I had a lot of money, either as a person or a nation, and wanted to influence people, and I was doing so by agreeing to loan them money and help them do things, I'd try and help them do things that sort of really worked, but that hasn't always been the case, has it? Tell us about the Chinese finance bridge over the Muraka Canyon in Montenegro.
Well, the Montenegrin bridge has become a kind of iconic sign, the bridge to nowhere, and I think people in China will point out that it wasn't actually their idea in the first place, but it's something that Montenegro did by itself and then got into difficulties and then asked for Chinese financing. But that, of course, doesn't make it any better, and the financing of it is expensive. It's obviously an increased burden on the budgetary arrangements in Montenegro. And I think it's become a kind of symbol for people who are critical of Chinese involvement. They're critical of the terms of the relatively high interest rates, and they're worried about the debt sustainability.
Sure, I get that. I mean, that's been evidence in, what, Sri Lanka and other places. But the bridge strikes me as unusual. I mean, even if the Montenegrins decided to build it, started building it, ran into trouble, I can't say that if I wanted to be a mate of someone and I had a lot of money, I'd sort of try and make more money out of their trouble by lending them more at higher rates. But so given that the shape of globalism is changing, what can you see happening in Europe that is, if you like, a different type of globalisation, a more binding together than just money travelling freely around the world?
Well, I think there's also the point that globalisation needs infrastructure, and this belt part of the initiative does aim at land infrastructure. So it's about railroad connections, it's about power transmission. They're both very important, and Europe really needs more connections for both of those. At the moment, for instance, this is not really to do with the Belt and Road Initiative, but there's a big political dispute in Italy about the high-speed train linkage with France. So Europe really does need this kind of investment, but clearly when you're thinking about infrastructure, it's very, very important to get the geography of it right and to get it in the right place. And infrastructure built in the wrong place is just going to be useless. It's going to be a debt burden. It's not going to create that many jobs. And people often live to regret these high prestige infrastructure projects.
You have an example of that, don't you, in terms of railways?
Well, yes. I mean, I'm a historian, so I was thinking of the story before the First World War, when this kind of globalization as an alternative to Britain's fundamentally maritime globalization was also very popular. So Russia constructed the Trans-Siberian Railroad, and the Germans pushed for a Berlin to Baghdad railroad that was just about viable in the bit that went to Constantinople, to modern Istanbul. But then when it goes across Anatolia, it really runs into the sand, actually, literally.
I'm talking with Harold James, Professor of History and International Affairs at Princeton University in New Jersey, and we're talking about the new globalisation, maybe China's Belt and Road. It's a sort of sad commentary, isn't it, on the nature of governance that people get these ideas, and sometimes once they're out of the box, there's no putting them back. Even when people come and say that's a ridiculous idea, once the decision's made, it's extraordinarily hard to turn it around.
Yes, no, that's absolutely right. But, you know, I think you have to say in fairness that the old kind of globalization with the multilateral development banks and so on, that also had its problems and its white elephants and its hydroelectric works and places that weren't properly thought out and were geologically vulnerable.
Well, Harold, you're sounding particularly fair there in that comment. I mean, it is true, isn't it? Everybody makes mistakes. Every person, every organization, every government. And the expectation that some in the community have, that no one will ever make a mistake, there will be no, you know, government stuff-ups, is just insanity, really.
No, and big infrastructure projects are particularly vulnerable to that. And in rich industrial countries, we have immense problems in finding the locations for airports or seaports or railroad lines, and it gets held up and it's complicated and complex. And that's right. So I think, you know, the point of the article was really just to say that China is walking into a potentially quite difficult area in this initiative.
Well, I think probably the world is, but I have to say, Harold James, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for joining us again on Counterpoint.
It's great being with you, Amanda. Thank you.